Okay. So I'm the last talk before the forum, then the reception, and then the food, right? And it's a nice subdued atmosphere at the end of the day. And I've been looking and listening and remembering conversations we had, I feel like around August or so of last year about this. So I'm looking in the audience and you heard some about background, and I've been involved in geosciences professionally. My first was a postdoc at Georgia Tech in 99, paleogeochemistry. And at that point, my postdoc advisor said, if you can win some fellowships, I'll make you a research scientist too, and then you can get your own funding. So I applied for two and I won two, and then I took off with my career. While I was at Tech was the first time I also directed a program for professional development and mentoring for grad students. And so I've had kind of that dual career, went from Georgia Tech to a professor, University of South Florida College of Marine Science, grad-only program. Most recently, before leaving academia, I was assistant vice provost for faculty recruitment and an environmental science associate professor. So my area is coastal, freshwater, man's impact on the environment, using radiogeochemistry as tools, looking at a lot of the clays and other things. And I found myself using my science really to help facilitate the advancement of others. So I used it as a tool to work with others. So with that, I will say, let's talk about this subject. And this is not, I told earlier, I'll be the last Android and PC standing. And so I still have my Android, I'm on a Mac. So let's try to make this work. Okay, so, you know, someone mentioned that we're talking about a big problem, talking about things starting from early, you know, childhood on. And so I've reached and touched both of those ends. So whether it's informal science, like at the Dallas Public Aquarium, or working with undergrads visiting my lab for the summer, or grad students or postdocs and others, there's work to be done. So now I'm going to just down arrow. Okay, so we're scientists and we like to have order. We're following a schedule. I'm going to try to stick to this. And then we like case studies. So I'm going to give you a case study. And then we're going to take this case study so I can kind of drill home some points that I want to make. And so what we're going to do is outlined here. And we're talking about not only case study, but the science, the research. What have we learned? What are we going to do? Then I'm going to give you some strategies. And we'll talk about professional development, the importance of it, and the fact that it's not just this newish thing for underrepresented minorities or women, but it's stuff that's been going on as apprenticeships and everything else for years and years and years. And then we'll get into some strategies that we can help grad students and postdocs be able to, let's see, effectively portray themselves in such a way that they are team-oriented to work on the interdisciplinary problems and stuff, which is a little different than when some of us were in grad school. It's a different model. So let's talk about that. And so we'll move on, and then we'll see about questions. So if this case study works, I'm going to show you a little video clip. And this was in 2016. Fox News had a segment on Black History Month, and so they were airing it, and I was one of the four people, four Fridays in the month of February, I was one of those. And so I'm going to show you this, and we're going to use my career as this case study. Double click, right? One finger. Okay. Well, I need to put my mic here for sound. You think you have sound on? Okay. So let's pause it. No sound. Okay. And why I need to put my mic down, maybe?
It should be plugged in.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So this doesn't count against my time?
No, no.
Okay.
Let's try it again.
All right.
Why don't you just put your mic down in front of
it? Okay. You want the speaker is somewhere here.
In our partnership with the Ailes Apprentice Program, we continue to honor our celebration of Black History Month. Joining us once again is Harris Faulkner, my co-host from Fox News's Outnumbered, our noon show, and the anchor of Fox Report Weekend. Harris is here. Good Good to see you. Good morning. It's been an exciting morning. Got to see Ainsley for a little bit there. What a blessing.
This is great to see her back. But I always look forward to your pieces,
well,
Harris. What do you have this morning?
I'm so excited. I'm going to tell you today about a woman who became one of the first black chemical oceanographers in all of America, Dr. Ashanti Johnson, a professor at the University of Texas at Arlington. She's helping lead the science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM community. And take note, Dr. Johnson is more than a teacher, she's a role model, inspiring a brand new generation now of diverse scientists throughout America.
For me, the uniqueness of the ocean is the unknown, the vast amount of things yet to be discovered. There's absolutely no boundaries there.
Scientist, professor, mentor, mother, Dr. Ashanti Johnson, one of the first African-American chemical oceanographers in the nation, and a leading voice in the STEM field. Growing up, she soaked up as much as she could about the deep blue sea.
My earliest memories of the ocean would be watching PBS Jacques Cousteau. In third grade, that's what I decided I wanted to do.
We would see a spark in her eye, and then from that, expose her to as much of her area of interest.
My parents would park, and I would just go through every museum, every different exhibit, seeing the little girl grow up, little shadows of her through here. And I had no clue about what was in store. I'm glad I've been along for the ride, but I didn't know.
A ride filled with exciting stops. In 1993, she became the first African-American to earn a degree in marine science from Texas A&M University in Galveston. Fast forward to graduate school. She received her doctorate in oceanography from Texas A&M College Station. But even in the late 1990s, Dr. Johnson faced more than academic challenges.
Race was an issue, not only for me, but as the community. When I was there my first year of grad school, they had a Ku Klux Klan rally. A professor referred to me as a little black girl. So it was a sense of isolation, but I was committed to overcoming. When I was in grad school at Texas A&M in oceanography, I was the only African-American. And to date, there has not been another African-American to receive a PhD in chemical oceanography from A&M.
It was after earning her doctoral degree that her true love became clear, mentorship. In 2003, NASA invited her to kickstart a pilot program to help STEM students from diverse backgrounds through mentorship and professional development opportunities.
The MSPhDs program is taking really talented students and providing them opportunities to be able to connect with those scientists that will help them with their career to the next level. So they're already capable. We just help provide them with the platform and the belief that they can do it. Jump over those hurdles, climb those fences, do whatever you need to be. So once you get on the other side, you can affect the change that you want.
She's so full of life and love and positivity, encouragement. She has definitely helped make who I am today.
Seeing Dr. Johnson in this role as this black powerful woman in academia, it meant so much for me. It told me that, you know what, you can achieve that as well.
I have been blessed to be able to help over 250 students in my MSPhD's program achieve their academic dreams.
From NASA to the National Science Foundation and her leadership with the Institute for Broadening Participation, there's no question why in 2010, she was awarded the Presidential Award for Excellence in Science, Mathematics, and Engineering Mentoring.
All of you are demonstrating why teaching and mentoring is so important and why we have to support you.
It was an amazing thing. It was almost surreal. One of the reasons that there's not more diversity in STEM fields is the lack of opportunity. It's not the lack of talent for underrepresented minorities, it's truly the lack of opportunity.
People like Dr. Johnson herself can help encourage and promote and keep propelling it forward.
It doesn't matter if you are a minority, if you are different in the room, you always have something to bring, and you have to believe in yourself because you are needed.
Her mentoring to others is not out of the textbook. Her mentoring to others is because she's been there. She knows how it feels to be belittled because of her color, and as a result, not really acknowledging her intellect.
The most joyful thing that I get is watching the accomplishments of my students. I think my legacy is being able to say there was a little girl who grew up in Dallas, Oak Cliff, who said in third grade she wanted to be an ocean scientist. And ways were made, and she was able to do it. So if she could do it, then there's nothing stopping other little girls.
Bring it on in. All right, good job, Michelle.
Well, I tell you, you spend 2 seconds with Dr. Johnson, she's got a ton.
Paris. Okay. All right. So anyway, that's our case study that we're going to talk about. And if you listened to that, you heard early exposure, you heard mentoring, you heard professional development, desire to help others, exposure, and you know that aquarium, the Dallas Aquarium, now it's the Dallas Children's Aquarium. Back in the 70s, it was free. And so there was also not the economic barrier to be able to go there as one off or a family of however many to getting there to be able to be exposed to those things. Okay, so that's that. But then I want to talk about this, and this is just another really quick video. We're talking about diversity. This is a session, and you have to ask the question, why is it important? Why? Why do we want to do it? And so you hear about it, oh, it's the thing to do, and everybody who does an NSF proposal needs to do a broader impact statement. You have to show it. You have to say you're going to do something. What do you really want to do? How you do it? Do you get some people over on the side to do something for you so you can really focus on what you want to do? But diversity is more than just one of those have-tos. It's one that we will continue to need to do in order to advance as a nation. So with that, this video, I've shared it at different universities around the United States. And the first time I asked a group that were inviting me, two white females, I want you to look at this because I think it's worth using, but I don't want to offend. So I want to tell you about this, and you might get a little uncomfortable, but it's okay. We'll work our way back out of that and then have some tools and good discussion. So with that, let's move on to this. I'm learning this mat. Yeah.
I want every white person who would be happy to be treated as this society in general treats our citizens, our black citizens. If you, as a white person, would be happy to receive the same treatment that our black citizens do in this society, please stand. You didn't understand the directions. If you white folks want to be treated the way blacks are in this society, stand. Nobody's standing here. That says very plainly that you know what's happening. You know you don't want it for you. I want to know why you're so willing to accept it or to allow it to happen for others.
So that's it. Do you guys hear it? Because it was kind of low. The point of it was she was in and she saw her audience and she said pretty bluntly, I want you white folks who want to be treated like blacks are treated in the United States to stand up. And she said, nobody's standing. Why aren't you standing? If you're not standing, you realize that something's wrong and it's happening to others. So why are you letting it happen without being part of that solution? That was the take-home message of that video. And so we know it exists. We do. And sometimes that some of us are more active to try to say, hey, that's wrong, let's not do that, or let's try to make an extra opportunity happen for somebody who's been disenfranchised. But then other times, we just might not see it. And so the idea is that we need to all see it and be an active role in playing. So what I'm going to focus on is when we talked about diversity with NSF kind of talk, as underrepresented minorities, women in some fields, persons with disabilities, Native Americans, Hispanics, Alaska Natives, Native Hawaiians, other Pacific Islanders, blacks, or African Americans. That's what NSF defines. That's what I'm going to focus on. So then I want to get to why we need it, okay? So this is not a feel good. This is not something that's an option. It's something that and this is a diverse group of people here from different countries, but if the United States wants to remain competitive as a nation in STEM, then we're going to have to embrace it. There's untapped talent in our country, and not only that, some of you might have heard of Scott Page, and he's from the University of Michigan, and he's done a lot of research on problem solving. And so he's had people in the same group, same background, be approached and have to approach a problem, and he's had others from diverse backgrounds. The diverse background problem solvers outperform those from the same like group. So I'm from Dallas. You have somebody from Dallas, whole group of people from Dallas, from my neighborhood. We try to approach the problem maybe the same way. But if you get somebody from Dallas, California, New Mexico, and other kind of places, and then they're able to bring their context, their upbringing into a situation, their perspective, then they're able to form unique problem solving suggestions. And so that's what Scott Page's work focuses on. So if we want to, as a country, focus on the fact that we want to have higher percentages of successful STEM solutions, you know, there's that one saying that says, today's solutions are tomorrow's problems. And my work was dealing with radiogeochemistry. So Chernobyl happened not too far before that. You had the concrete sarcophagus that was encasing that stuff. It started to deteriorate, and then there was leakage. That was that day's solution, but it became a problem. So if we're going to get past that, then we have to bring everybody to the table, because otherwise we're going to get the same types of solutions being proposed over and over again. So it's really a matter of solving our more challenging problems and our continued advancement as a society. So I graduated with my PhD in 1999. This was the dialogue. It was a good year. I was there's a conference called DISCO, Dissertation Initiative Symposium for Chemical Oceanographers. That was in Hawaii, and so it was for students all around the world. I got in. That was great. And there was one, a dialogue. Dissertation Initiative something for limnologists and oceanographers. I got in, and it was in Bermuda. So in one summer, I went from Hawaii to Bermuda with the top, you know, coming out, that crew of 1999, aquatic scientists. We were going to be this group of people that looked together, learned each other, so we could collaborate and work on the future. So here I am. And that's me. And somebody mentioned that kind of bar room, kind of what happens at going to the bar and stuff like that. Well, competitively, I was able to get in. Academically qualified, research qualified, socially, although I was right in the middle of everybody, there were two of us that were not Caucasian. She was a friend, kind of, and myself. But guess what? At the end of every session, she went to her dorm room, I went to my dorm room, and they all hung out. And at that point, as a new PhD, I didn't know how to relate or break the barrier. And at that point, as new PhDs, they didn't try to either. And so you fast forward that, as a professor at University of South Florida, we get to these staff meetings, faculty meetings. And most of the faculty there were almost old enough to be my dad, and they're white males. And I was young, and I had a newborn and all kinds of stuff happening. And they would have these pre-meetings at the local tavern. So they would be at the bar, they talk about things that was going to happen, and then we get to the faculty meeting, and we get ready to vote. There were other two other women. One, she was close to being the age of my mother, and the other, she had an associate, she was an associate professor, lived kind of remotely, in a nearby town, had tenure, just wouldn't really come around. So that was it. And so we go to these faculty meetings, and they would already know what was going to go down. Decisions made and everything else, because it happened at the tavern. It happened before. Did the guys think that they were excluding me on purpose? And they were going to discuss while they go socialize with their peers over beer what should be done for our college? I don't think they purposely did it, but I'd come in and scratch in my head, like, we hadn't even brought that subject up yet. Why are y'all ready to vote? You know? And so there's an awareness that needs to be happening. Socializing at one level is fine. But really, at some point, when you start talking about what should happen with the college and all that, you guys should pull back, you know, and let's wait for the meeting. Because when you're not in that group and you go into the meeting, then you're feeling excluded. And so that happens in a lot of places. So I'm in the middle of my crew, but I'm isolated. So now let's go into some data. Resident population in the United States, this is what it looks like. It's getting more diverse, and this is in 2012. That's your population set. This is the STEM workforce. Most of them white men, then white women, then Asian. And this little section right here is what's identified as the underrepresented minority group. Okay? So that's 2015. Now, what I want to do, degrees in STEM, URM, science and engineering. And if you know our field, geoscience, it actually looks worse than this. But let's look at the doctorate level. Here you go, right? So from 1993 to 2012, we haven't broken 10%. So that's one of the reasons why NSF said we have to have broader impacts. We have to have this happening because we keep saying the STEM is the great way to go, and we've been trying to do it, but for some reason we're leaving people out. So now let's make a purposeful effort to engage people so that we can continue to move forward. So with that, people ask, well, what should you do? How should you solve it? And it's kind of like saying, how do you want your favorite, I'm going to say gumbo, to be made, right? Because it's not just one ingredient. You have to kind of spice it up and mix it up so it suits you. And so me, I cook gumbo, and I'm known for that. I cook on all four burners. I cook, you know, two medium pots because I have to go for the middle of the road. And I cook a mild and a hot. And so for different situations, you know what pot to get. It's the same thing. You won't say for physical oceanography, the way you solve this problem is to use this piece of equipment. None of you guys would be left in here, right? Because we know that it has to come from different perspectives. We have to use different tools. We have to come together, talk about it, scratch our heads, figure out what to do, and say, aha, now let's go to NASA or whoever and propose a grant for $3 million to form a center to be able to do XYZ with these teams. So if we know that's what it takes for our field, why are we wanting to devote like 10% or less to a budget for diversity issues? So what we've learned, it's different. Let's talk about this. My advisor came up in oceanography early on as a female. She was definitely excluded. So guess what? She was a single PI. She wrote single or maybe co-authored papers, and she groomed me up to do what? Not to play with others, but to work in my lab by myself. She and I would collaborate. We'd talk about it, and we wrote two authored papers, right? And we wrote SQL out the proposals. But guess what? All the guys in the building were working as teams, right? And so they were going for long-term ecological research centers. They were going for big projects. And she was going for a small proposal from ONR. But so if we know that, and I had an option of when I became a professor, you know, you get a PhD and that's a license to teach others. Run dollars and all kinds of stuff. But when you do that, I had an option to be a, there's low battery, low battery. When you do that, you have an option to do the same or to take a look to see if there should be shifts, right? Evolution. And evolution showed that in the geosciences, it was time to be interdisciplinary. It was time to work in teams. It was time to be able to collaborate. And so you had to know how to play well with others to do that. When I went to AGU meeting, and I've talked to the AGU presidents about this, I said that I would never go back again when I went to my first one. Because I was one of two people of color. I saw that entire meeting. It was me and a vendor somewhere in the trade area. I mean, that was it. And so then my work was on Russian Arctic sediments, and my advisor, who was trying to be helpful, told me not to publish under my first name because that sounds too ethnic, just publish under A. And so I'm standing in front of my poster, these people from Germany and all that trying to see it because this is what's going on, and my samples are very rare and blah, blah, blah. And they're looking all around me to the point where I finally said, is there anything I can help you with? Oh no, I'm looking at that. Well, that's my paper. One guy literally kind of stepped back, like, oh my gosh. Because A was just somebody, but his perception of what A, who that should look like, was definitely not somebody like me. And so I left AGU saying I'm never going back. Then NSF and NASA said, you know, years later, we'd like to have a project in geoscience diversity. And so if you're going to succeed in geoscience as a community, you need to be able to go to that meeting and master it. You need to be able to connect with it, do things. And so that's the first meeting I take my students to every year. So you have to know the shifts. You have to be able to train the next generation. What we've learned, timing and coordination is important. So we've talked about some people mentor, some people advise. There are some people who have committees that these folks are excellent scientists, but maybe not great advisors. They're excellent at their work, but maybe they have a rough personality. So what do? It's kind of this thing. I used to say I collect mentors, but now instead of saying I collect them, a friend of mine said it's a composite mentor. So you have different people who speak into you for different parts of it. So
I had on my committee at A&M two of the radio geochemists. That sounds great. The problem is they couldn't stand each other. And they were my co-advisors, right? And they would, like, if this one said that, the other one said that. And so I was tugged back and forth. I was smart enough to get the dean on my committee of my college, the associate dean of College of Engineering on my committee. I got some other people who, and then I would go, I'm ready to graduate. Have you seen all this work I've done? They don't like each other. And they're keeping me stuck in the middle of it. But so the dean was like, oh, surely not. I'm like, watch this. Let's have a meeting. You know, because we're not supposed to be like that as scientists. We're supposed to rise above. But at that certain point in my meeting, and Bob Deuce was my dean. I love him. Bob Deuce reached over to my co-advisor and said, that's enough. Because they were letting their personal issues come in. And so what I want to do is tell you sometimes your field might not be absolutely aligned with somebody's, but if you have the right heart, be willing to serve on their committee. Because sometimes they need that voice of calm, that they need that person who can help guide them in other ways. My advisor was not going to help guide me in collaborative research because she didn't do it. So I had to have somebody else on my committee who could tell me how to do that, to say, oh my gosh, you're scared to speak in public, which I was. What you have to do is try getting into Toastmasters so you can practice that. Toastmasters, nobody told me about that. What is that? I remember the first presentation that I actually did, I was so nervous that my body temperature spiked. And before that presentation was over, my glasses had fogged up because I sit on my cheeks. I couldn't see. I was embarrassed. I think people were looking at my glasses instead of me. So, like, for years, I would just do presentations and not be able to see you. And then I was like, I got to do better. So when I could finally do that, I was like, yes. So realize you all have things that you can say and help each other. But we have to know that we have a role to play. And if that's not advising on the scientific content, you can advise on the professional aspects, the career paths. You can speak into somebody so you can say, hey, you can be successful. And there's this thing called a champion. So we can be advisors, we can be mentors, and we can be champions. And the way they explain champions to me, the doors are closed, and you might be a champion for somebody going up for tenure because you're, you know, tenured and you get to vote. And at that point, there needs to be a champion that can say, this person might not look like us, or they're a little bit different background or whatever, but guess what? They've done good work. And so those times are when champions are needed. So think about that. So we talked about the case study. These are the things that have been shown scientifically to show that they're important. Community support. Talked about my mom. Talked to my teachers and all this being very helpful. Authentic science engagement. I was the first high school volunteer for the Dallas Public Aquarium. I went so many times, I could tell people, hey, you want to go see the turtle? Let me show you this. You want me to show this? As a little kid, I was guiding people around. So when I got to high school, I asked them, can I come help? So that was my first behind the scenes where I saw that I was cutting up fish to feed to other fish. That sounds okay, but for me, I'm like, really? I hadn't really thought about the food chain, right? So there was different things happening. Professional development. I was in different organizations. Campus climate and culture. I tell people Texas A&M College Station was an absolute excellent academic experience. It was hard. It really was. So you heard the thing about the little black girl. Told somebody earlier about the one where a person questioned whether or not my paper, which was very good, if my advisor helped me write it, because they just did not think that I could write that well. I was told by another professor, you should take my class because so-and-so took it, and he's really smart. They knew nothing about my grades, but they were implying that I was not. And so there were challenges, and there were things to overcome, but I came to get my education. And so sometimes people will be suffering in silent just to make it through. And so at the end of the story, College Station, the dean told me, you've been one of our best students. Would you consider joining faculty? And I looked them in the eyes and said, I endured a lot of things as a grad student. So it will not be until those people are retired that I ever come back here to be on your faculty. Because the thing is, there were things that were done wrong, and this is what we have to kind of counsel. Somebody talked about the young knowing, thinking they know everything. I could have challenged those people at those times, but I was not in the power position. If I challenged them, I would have lost. And so I had to bite my tongue, remember I was there, make it happen. And at the end of the day, I got my degree. They realized that, hey, she actually is what her papers say she is. Her grades said she was good. Her GRE said she was good. Oh my gosh, she's qualified to be here. But that took place 3 or 4 years after I've been here. So with that, just realize that we talked about mentors, mentoring, campus climate. You can help with that. You can help with that. You can have an open door policy. You can be an ear. You can kind of even look to see what might be going on and say, hey, Jim, did you notice that this person is not really getting engaged with us? Let's go ahead and invite them to something. You can make that happen. Role models. I get emails, I get things happening now from young people across the United States. Actually, some of my Facebook friends, a lot of them are from Cambodia. I was the Department of State's ambassador to this STEM symposium in Cambodia a couple years ago. And I told them they had a new sport, because in 5 days they had me giving 15 talks. And I'm like, are you out of your mind? It was exhausting. But now it's like seeing those kids that were wonderful, and now they're all on Facebook. How are you doing, Dr. Johnson, and all this kind of stuff. So even though I just spoke with them for a little time and said, pretty much, you can do it, and you keep saying it, you keep working at it until somebody listens to you so you can make it happen, don't give up, I've become role models. Life, work-life balance for women, it's real. It's real. Because we make a decision. When is the right time to have a child, if we have a child? And the answer that some guys would do is say never. My postdoc advisor told me, I was like, I got some exciting news to share with you. And he's like, you're not pregnant, are you? No, but I won an award. But guess what that told me? Don't get pregnant while you're working with him, because that's not what he wants, right? And then if you fast forward to women who've been through the careers, some of them have regrets that they didn't have babies, and now that season is gone. So if there's some way to be supportive, and I was learning from Lori some of the things that you guys have here, that's just wonderful, but realize that life only happens once, and to look at an investment of a scientist who's a female as a long-term investment, not just, oh my gosh, she's about to have, she's in childbearing years. What are we gonna do? What if she has a child? We do not lose our minds. We become more focused. We get it done. I had three, nursing mom, made it happen. So you'd be amazed at how efficient you become at utilizing your time and even typing with one hand while you're holding the baby like this. So give us a break and realize just because we choose to have a family, we have not decided to opt out of science. So make it a little easy for us. Okay, so NMS PhDs, every year we go to national academies and we take that picture. And so then what happens is we have our alumni go back and they take that picture and they post it because they're just saying this is part of the community that we've been in. And let them know that they can be part of your community. Now, wrapping up this kind of case study, talked about all this. My role model was Jacques Cousteau. At that point, I thought he was a marine scientist. Now I know he was an underwater photographer who did amazing movies, but he inspired me. And what inspired me was actually him showing me all the different things at different parts of the world, but also the different people. People with different accents, people, you know, that were having fun while they were doing science. And I said, that's what I want to do. So the idea of interdisciplinary international science is what I wanted to do since I was a young girl. That's the Dallas Aquarium, my family being supportive. My mom is my best coach, and she actually had her master's when I was in school, and she went and enrolled in a doctorate program when I was in grad school. And so I got a chance to see my mom getting a doctorate, because she said, if you're doing it, I'm going to do it too. So with that, Texas A&M Galveston, phenomenal experience. I was student body president because people encouraged me. I was one of 8 black people there. So I did not win because all the black people came out and voted for me. I won because they saw my heart and they saw what I wanted to do for the school. So realize this is the surface and look below that. all these different things happened. It was not until my undergrad years that I actually explored the ocean. I grew up in Dallas. The closest I could get was the Dallas Public Aquarium. Did not go to the coast, didn't have that experience until I went to school. So fast forwarding, that's Texas A&M Oceanography Building. I was on the ninth floor. It was one of the loneliest experiences of my life. This I share with millennials. Science happens when science happens. I'm in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. We're on station. Now, if I had told the captain, man, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. Can we reschedule this for 8? I would have missed my station. So science happens when science happens. We have to be committed and dedicated. This, I was at an Arctic Ottawa conference in Ottawa, standing on a river. I grew up in Dallas. I was seeing people ice skate to work. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is so cool. I have to stand there. But seeing these kind of perspectives open up have been the ones that working hard, doing the science, having the experiences. So with that, I've been able to mentor. This picture is actually me as a grad student. He was an undergrad that I met at an ASLO conference. Fast forward, I was very impressed with him as an undergrad. When I became a professor at the University of South Florida, he was finishing his master's. He became my first PhD student. I'm saying that to say it's the impact that students make. You never know where that goes. So explain to your students, your young postdocs, and everybody else, you're always on. You're always on, because now there's this generation of, if it shouldn't matter what I put on Facebook, it shouldn't matter what I put on Twitter or whatever, you're always on. So because he made an impact and a good impression then, he became my first PhD student. He's a professor at UPR. So I can go on and on about that, but just know, this is what I've shown you, and part of the people we were meeting earlier talked about life stories. This is called concept map. We know science, we know ways to present stuff. And these are the colors of the different factors. And this is really my life in academia, my life as an undergrad, grad student, and on, that we could talk about what were the impacts to bring me where I am today. And so I encourage you to let your students, your new postdocs, your scientists, your community know. In addition to doing research on this, let me tell you about me. Because when you learn more about each other, you can overcome barriers, you can see something to bond with, and you can be a stronger team. So I talked about those. I'm going to go pretty fast on these. I think this is worth stopping. I won the presidential award from President Obama. They called me and said, you won this award, we want you to come. I'm like, problem, I'm a nursing mom. I don't know how I'm going to do that, because I'm going to need somebody to watch my baby. And they said, okay, do you have somebody that can get through security clearance? So I said, sure, call my mom. Mom, you want to go to the White House? And so they kept making accommodations that my child and my mother had to get security clearance. And so they would put them in different places at the White House, they put them across at a hotel nearby, but they kept making it happen. My grad student is like an uncle to my kids. So realize that's the family. We need to embrace who they are. And realize for my underrepresented minorities, legacies are important. That's my grandmother. My grandmother cleaned houses, cleaned places for a living. She didn't know about radiogeochemistry, but she knew that her baby, her granddaughter, went to the White House and got this award. So realize that when you look at a student of color, that it's not just them saying, oh, I want to do this. They have to sometimes get approval from their families. You want to be an oceanographer? You want to be, you know, a planetary physicist? You want to do what? What kind of job are you going to get? Because you're the smart one, and we're really counting on you to make a difference in your family. I don't understand, what kind of job are you going to get? And as a geoscience community, we do a very poor job of saying, what can you do when you get this degree? So for me, you know, I would say, hey, Grandma, you know, I look at chemistry of water and sediments, so I can tell you, because she's the fisher, my family fishes. I can tell you if it's safe to eat the fish or not from a lake or a river or something like that. Okay, that's important, because we know, we need to know if it's safe to eat a fish. So understand that it needs to be relevant, and it needs to be that you're taking their babies and you're asking them to make an investment of 4 to 10 years, maybe, of their lives, and what's going to come at the end of that. And then you're asking, as me as a minority, am I willing to make an investment of 4 to 10 years, and I'm going to be treated like an outsider until I retire, because I don't look like you. Because that's what you ask a lot of people to do. Are you willing to be that outsider? And so you say, we have these flyers, we have these posters, and we want them to come, but they're not coming. It's more than just money to get them through the door, but what happens when they're there? When you have an REU experience or something in your lab in the summertime, and you have them come, they work in your lab, what happens when they leave your lab? What kind of community is around them? What kind of engagement happens? When you have grad students come to a university, and it's far, Puerto Ricans come into Princeton, where do they go for Thanksgiving? Do they go home for Christmas? Are you okay with them staying on the island for Three Kings Day? Because I wasn't at first. I really wasn't. I had about 4 or 5 grad students from Puerto Rico. I had detectors that had to be cooled every 2 weeks with liquid nitrogen. 2 weeks, that's Christmas break. Come back and cool it off so we can keep it going. And they had to say, no, I'm not coming back till the middle of January. What? I was very frustrated with that. I'm like, my samples need to keep running. That is too long. What is your problem? And then finally, Warner, being very nice, let me explain to you, on our island, King's Day, Three Kings Day is bigger than Christmas for some of us. And when I got that, it's like, this is a major family holiday. So I said, okay, let's just power down the detectors. And I had to be comfortable with losing a month of labor for data so that they could be true to their community. So realize you need to understand who the persons are, people are, and give them what they need to be successful. Okay, family support, community support. We talked about that. One of the things that when you go to colleges and universities, and I ask what happens on Thanksgiving and what happens on these breaks that they don't go back home, have you connected them with the community? Because you probably are going to go eat turkey with somebody you know. But have you said, hey, there's some local churches that adopt college kids? You know, what have you done to find out what's there so that you can help them to overcome that loneliness? Because at Texas A&M, I can tell you that some people came when I was there with plans to get a PhD, but they were lonely, they were isolated, and at that point it was, you know, Ku Klux Klan had been there, and they opted out and they got a master's and left. Say, I'm done. I can't do it anymore. So there are some things you can do. Okay, professional development, got to have it. Please don't be the person who has a big lab group do the research and then you go make all the presentations. Please don't do that. And when they're going to the conferences on your behalf, work in advance to have them connect with folks. Email your colleagues that you know are going to be at the meeting. Hey, my postdoc's going to be there. My so-and-so is going to be there. Connect, have them connect so they can maximize that moment. Mentoring, got to have it. We talked about that. Nobody does science on their own anymore. So if they don't do science on their own, help them become more collaborative with each other. You can do that by helping them complete a development plan. I'm shy. How are you going to overcome it? Toastmasters. How are you going to do it? Practice, do, what is it? Student teaching. Do something to help them get over it. Marketing for student success. I'm really an introvert, but I had to watch an extrovert who could literally have anybody tell them their life story in about 5 minutes. And I watched them like I was a scientist until I became comfortable. One of the first things that I do is saying, oh, that's a nice necklace you're wearing. I find something to connect with somebody that breaks the ice so then you're feeling comfortable in talking with them. So help your students become that, your new scientists become that. Elevator presentation. You can go for days talking about your field, but can you make it happen in 30 seconds? And you need to be able to boil that down and have your students be able to boil that down, your postdocs, your research scientists, your new collaborators. You want to be able to talk about this new potential proposal that you guys are going to submit somewhere, and he happens to run into the program officer. Program officer does not have 3 hours to hear about what you want to do. Help them with that. So I think with that, this is just visuals, and then we'll leave real quick. Be done. When I look at your programs in different places, are you representing where you can visually on the web? This is where we go now to look to search, that you are a diverse group that's welcoming, that your science is welcoming. Or are you looking at it instead of saying, these are the students, that's the scientists. This is students and scientists are dorky looking. Is that what we're looking at? Now, for this one, I love this. Because here's a woman of color doing really, really cool chemistry. Very cool. And if I were a student, I'd be like, I want to go there, and I want to be in her class. So look how you're representing it. Again, our typical representation, the teacher, students. That is a cool girl doing some cool things, right? So look at the opportunities where you can on Facebook, on your websites, to say, you too, we're factoring on you, we're including you. So with that, there are a lot of different things that NSF runs and other stuff that I've given that examples, and I want to say thank you. And if you want to learn more, there's some recent papers that I've done on it. So that's it.
Does anyone have any comments or questions for Ashanti?
And I will apologize for my stuttering. I've been up since 3 o'clock East Coast time. It's been a long day.
Did you raise your hand? Can you say a little bit about the imposter syndrome? And how would you recommend, as somebody who knows other people who have such a syndrome, mm-hmm. how would you recommend dealing with it?
So the imposter syndrome is real. And so that's this idea of, for instance, me being here to speak in front of you. Am I really worthy of being here? Have I done enough, or am I just faking this? And what happens is that people who seem to be provided with opportunities, for some reason they can't put it in their mind and their heart that they're actually supposed to have that opportunity. And so whether that comes from whatever, growing up or different things, it is real and it's something that people face. And to speak to it, you know, one of the things as a scientist, and I have a very critical eye, and I have to consciously make myself say good things. I might think good things about what people have done, but it doesn't come out. I focus on speaking the things that still need to be done, right? The errors that need to be made. And so what we can do is say, you know what? That was great. This, what you're proposing, is really good. Or say, hey, you know, this is what I'm thinking. And this is one that also is important for different groups. We don't want to challenge. We want to give, you know, who we see as figures of authority, respect. And so if one of you says something and we think scientifically it might be off, we might not feel comfortable in saying, I don't think you're right. I think it's this instead. So what you can say is, hey, this is my thinking, but I really value what, you know, your perspective. What do you think about this? Show me, am I right? Show me where I'm wrong. Help me push it so I can make it so that this is a really good thing. So I'll tell people that I'm working with, hey, look, I have to cut $300,000 in the budget. That's a real thing that had to happen. So you're over these federal programs, and I'm going to ask you really hard questions, and I'm going to have you push back where you need to, because I need to know what the boundaries are. So get them to be part of your problem-solving part so they can see what they're bringing to the table. But you'd be amazed about how qualified students or young scientists really don't think they deserve to be where they are.
I just wanted to add to that. I know something that I've experienced as a woman in science when I've been working with an older male mentor is that sometimes they're afraid to give me critical feedback, and I'm guessing a lot of the women in the room have experienced that, or you probably know someone who has experienced that, whether or not they've expressed that to you. And when you're working with someone who doesn't want to be critical because they're afraid of being labeled as sexist, that's almost just as destructive as actually being overtly sexist, because what happens is then you don't learn the skills that you need to learn in order to, you don't learn how to respond to professional criticism. You don't learn how to interact you know, with more senior scientists, for example, in the way that that someone who, you know, a mentor is more comfortable speaking to and giving critical feedback learns to interact. So that's sort of a it's, well, I completely agree with what Ashanti said with regards to focusing on positive feedback and giving students and mentees opportunities to contribute to problem solving and see what they're bringing to the table. I think that there's also a component of making sure that you just engage with them, period. Yeah. Don't be afraid that if you give them critical feedback that, you know, that is important critical feedback, that that you'll be labeled as sexist, because if you don't give them that feedback, they won't learn how to be a professional scientist. They won't learn how to write a good proposal. They won't learn, you know, how to write a paper that will, you know, that will be readily accepted by peer reviews.
So one thing, just kind of piggyback on that, when I'm working with students and young PhDs, and sometimes what I'll do is say, give me your, they want to talk with me, okay, give me your resume, give me your CV, let me see it, and then we can have a discussion. So I usually look at it, and then I print it out, and I start writing all over it, right? And then I give it to them. Before I give it to them, I said, look, I don't think that this really represents you well. And so I'm going to give this to you, and it's going to have a lot on it, and I'm going to ask you some questions, and you're going to go back, and you're going to fix it, and we're going to have a couple of rounds on this, because I want you to be represented well. So you'll grow from this, and this will be that. You know, and so we give it, we talk about it, and then really, it's this cycle. But at the end of it, they're like, oh my gosh, that's what I started with? This is where I'm at. It's the growth process. You know, even now, some of my collaborators, they're like, okay, now let's give it to her. And they said, in a former life, you could, alternative life, you could have been a copy editor, right? I'm like, right? But what we do is we're helping it be better. And as long as you can show them that where you're coming from is a space where you want them to be better, then you definitely need to do that. You don't want someone feeling like they're just super and their stuff is mediocre. You want it to be better. But you also don't want to be the one that never has anything good to say. You don't want to be that person either. Because then they shut out. They shut you out. They really do. They don't hear anything from you at that point.
So I had a question concerning, there's also experienced a pipeline issue, mm-hmm. in the sense that I specifically teach in Detroit,
okay.
faculty, Wayne State University, and one of the issues is, you know, not even getting enough student of color, not to talk about women of color, even as undergraduates to start with, and I think the problem starts actually in high school and even before that.
Yeah.
So if you can say a few things about that.
Yeah, and actually, one of these papers, because I completely agree, that was actually targeted at high school guidance counselors, right? Because when you're looking at this, what you're doing is you're seeing that, okay, if we aren't tracked in the United States by sixth grade and the right kind of career where we want to go academically, then we're not getting the right math, right? And then you get to college, and then you're supposed to be taken off at one level math, and you have to start a level down. So then you're behind the steps. And so, and then you want to be competitive for scholarships, fellowships, all these opportunities. So what should you be doing? One of the things that from people who have a generation of being professional, whether they've been university lawyers or whatever, it's more widely known that when you go off to college, you should find some internships, some summer opportunities, or something like that. Okay, when you don't have that background, when you're first generation, you go off to school from August to May, and you come home, go work at Walmart or wherever, and because school is only for school time stuff, and then you come back home to the family. Well, what happens is you might have a great GPA, but you don't have any experience, and so then you're not able to go to the next level. And so having these conversations about the pipeline, reaching into, I mean, one of the things is you guys can volunteer to be, you know, science fair judges. You can be speakers and all that, but you have to make those connections so that they are saying, wow, okay, it's not when I just walk in the door at this level. You need to start back beyond. So this paper actually outlines what should you do at the different levels. What should you expect to do? You should work in somebody's lab on campus when you're a freshman. You know, you start applying to be off campus by the time your sophomore year. You should be able to do these things so then by the time you are
looking for grad opportunities, you're able to be competitive. And then we have discussions when I'm talking with students, just to let you know, undergrad institutions is by the name of the institution, that's the reputation. When you get to grad school, it's who are you working with, right? Who's your advisor? But if, again, you're first generation, you don't know that. And so it's sharing the information to the audiences that can have the impact and volunteer so they can see you not only as that person on a picture somewhere, but, you know, he's pretty cool, she's pretty cool, she drives a motorcycle, you know, whatever it is. One of the things that I did real quick, and then I'll stop, I was approached by a couple young ladies years ago after a conference, and they said, we really appreciate what you're doing. I said, okay, thank you. And you look really nice. I said, okay, thank you. No, we really appreciate that you look really nice, because this is a geoscience meeting. And they said, you know, there are a lot of women who don't, and it makes it like you can also be a scientist and you can still look like a girl. That was important to them. And because of that, you know, even though I might be dead tired, when I go speak with young, undergrad audiences and grad, I make sure that I look nice. And then when they're like, oh my gosh, you have kids too? And so they need to see you as a whole person and see themselves as not following a career they give up, but where they can do everything they want to do.
So Caltech, we undergo sexual harassment training whenever we are in a management position. And there is a lot of discussion these days about implicit bias. And we are made aware of implicit bias, but are there studies that show how to effectively train people to overcome their implicit biases?
There are, and even some of them, when we talked earlier, having been on many, many search committees. And I want you guys to think about it. If you have been on university search committees, you look at two applications, and if one of them is a female or one of them has a name that doesn't sound common, you start really looking fine-tuned at where did they, who was their advisor, what paper did they publish, what journal was that in, and all that. Where you have another one, you're like, oh, okay, he looks like a good candidate, right? But you do more of a critical look, a critical eye for whatever reason, because you're already not saying they're both coming in like this. You're trying to make sure that this one is really even worthy to be considered with this one. And so those things play out. And there have been some research that shows just same kind of application, CVs, but changing names and making the name sound different, then all of a sudden that candidate is not as qualified as this other one. So it's real, and we have to have people now with all that, the training that happens, have somebody really be in there to kind of be that watchdog to say, hey, look, why are you asking about that one, not this one? And so again, those become those unknown champions.
You mentioned one aspect is these peer group effects that having clearly an effect on you, and I've seen that a lot at Caltech where I am too. Particularly one engineering program we have, which is very non-diverse. It's not my program, but we're doing a little bit better in some ways. But in any case, I think I've seen it many times now that students come in, women, other underrepresented minorities. The first year is very tough there, and in that tough first year, all the boys band together and do the homework together, and the girls are not part of the crowd, or otherwise underrepresented minorities. The one African American student who has come through there said the same thing, and it's very important to have a peer group, in particular in this first year, to do the homework together, to make it through for social support, but also just for solving the problems together. And it has a very pernicious effect because, in particular, the more sensitive people clearly feel isolated and eventually leave. Right. And it locks it into this situation that it is in right now, with lacking diversity grossly. And it seems harder to change. It's not something that's easily changed in any top-down fashion by some training or something for administrators and professors. It's really among the students and how they organize. How does one address that? How does one affect change there?
So I was thinking about a couple of different things. And one is like when you're having this orientation sessions, when you're able to build in community activity, bonding activities, partner activities, when you're looking at your work assignments, it's easy in labs, right? Because you usually have a lab partner. But when it's a classroom, you know, having some think pair shares and, you know, these other kind of cool stuff that you can use so that you're having, you're forcing an environment of collaboration. So then it's not me just saying, hey, can I come study with you? But okay, let's go do this assignment we've been given, right? And so we have to do that, because one of the things for, with the programs I run, I tell people, you might have survived undergrad school by yourself. You might have survived it. You could have done better if you actually worked in groups, right? But you could have done it. But when you get to grad school, you have to be able to work with other people, because there is somebody that's going to know what kind of test this person is going to give. They might even have copies of it. I know you guys don't want to hear that, but people do keep copies of it and pass it on. But if you're not in that crowd, I mean, like where they're starting from here, you're starting from here, right? And so you have to be able to relate, and that's that whole interpersonal skill. The other thing is you see that play out is when you have these well-qualified people who have their freshly minted PhDs, and then they're interviewing, but they're awkward. And you're like, academically, oh, he's great. Professionally, I think he'll fit in. Do you think he'll get along? I mean, do you think he'll really fit with us in our community? And I said he, but usually it's a she that we're talking about, or there's a different group. So you discount people because you say, oh, it's not the right fit. So we, as the people who are helping shape those individuals, have to say, you need to be able to play with others. If it doesn't come naturally, how can we do it? Because the idea of being this grumpy old professor off in the corner, we're not trying to hire those people anymore. We're trying to hire collaborators. And so we have to make those opportunities within the learning environment. So it's not, it's taken away from the students to work together, but it's an assignment that we are saying this must be done. And so that helps to open that door, because it's really awkward to say, hey, look, I don't know you, you don't know me, but it's a big group of y'all and I'm over by myself. Can I come work with you? That's a hard sell. You know, they're 18, they're 19, it's hard, you know. Let me introduce myself. And I want you to think about it, and this is one thing, and I was telling the group at Columbia, the idea for our field, and I want it to be different, but if you were to walk in a room that looks absolutely reversed, let me say it's gonna be 99% African American, would you be ready to sign up for a career for the next 30 years of being the only one that looks like you? That's what you're asking underrepresented minorities to do, because you're not trying to flip it. You know, at one instance, you're saying, let's bring one, let's bring another one, let's bring another. If we keep working, we might have 15 in 10 years. So you're asking us to be comfortable in being the only ones or very few for the rest of our careers. So you have to at least be nice. So if we work on being nice, then more people will come. And we also have to know what kind of job is at the end of it. Because we don't have the option, a lot of us, to just do what's in our heart. We have to also say, yes, this investment is worth it to my uncle, to my aunt, to my grandmother, to everybody else. Yes, I'm going to be a chemical oceanographer. Mother, I'm in the car, packed, this is my real story, packed to go to grad school, ready to drive. No, I don't want to be a medical doctor. I don't like cutting on stuff. Stop asking me that. You know? But because you're smart and doctors make money, you can do that. So these are some of the things that we need to be able to do better as a community. Okay. Reception time, panel time, what time? Okay.
I'd actually asked Jim McWilliams to speak about what I'm about to say. Is Jim here?
Okay.
I sort of anticipated that. My experience is almost the opposite of Ashanti's, that I grew up in South Africa, and my life didn't really start until I moved to the US. And my life is a story of succession of fortunate accidents. I knew nothing about ocean or atmosphere. I could add and subtract and so on. Anyway, I was extremely lucky and throughout my career, and I did not experience most of the things Shanti mentioned or that the women mentioned. And so you could ask, what was the big difference between me and them? And one factor, simply age, that when I came to the US in the 60s, it was shortly after Sputnik had been launched, and the people greatly admired scientists. The parents wanted their children to be scientists. My own son and most of his colleagues did not want to go to graduate school. Nowadays, you have to be an investment banker or something like that. And I think our big problem is, as I said earlier, we do science for two purposes. The one is out of curiosity, and the other one's for practical benefits. And I'm old enough to have seen an enormous change in the way this balance between the two. Since the end of the Cold War, the emphasis is entirely on what have you done for me lately. And support for science has fallen. And in some, I'm astonished by the degree to which the scientific community simply accepts this. The one, what I was counting on Jim to say, I'm sort of obliged to say it now, that I believe the IPCC does harm to the scientific effort. It's entirely focused on top-down science, and it's focused on science for practical benefits. There's very little support for science out of curiosity. We somehow have to persuade the electorate, the world at large, that science is a beneficial activity. We, as I said, if you listen, well, we all agree we teach science very poorly. And when I was fortunate, I left South Africa and I went to Harvard. And it's been said of Harvard that the most difficult thing next to getting in is getting out. Once they've accepted somebody, they simply do not accept that they've made a mistake. And as a consequence, they treat you extremely well. And they basically, as I said, I had none of the problems, discrimination. Obviously, in South Africa, you get a very thick skin about that type of thing. I was astonished by how easily people get offended. In South Africa, there's no subtlety about discrimination. And so the contrast coming here, much of it was simply invisible to me. I'm sure it happened. But the main point I want to make is the plea I made earlier, that we somehow have to persuade the public that science is an interesting topic, that the best introduction to science is our planet. They should be proud of it. Things they take for granted are miracles. What happens in the spring is absolutely amazing, especially in the East Coast. Things go from being dead to being... In a way, we have to find a way to get people interested in science, to want their children to be scientists. And then I believe it will contribute to solution to many of the problems we've been hearing about. That once parents urge their children, it's worthwhile studying science. Anyways, I just hope to end on an optimistic note, that we live on this amazing planet. Surely we can do better in getting the public, our children, interested in that.
I'm sorry that we didn't get to the panel discussion, but I didn't want to interrupt the flow of the conversation. But thank you, everybody, for coming and participating.